Interesting time in this economy, gang. Booming job market, protective tariffs going up, though. What is going on? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 9th of March. I do believe good as always to have you along, everybody. So listen, here's one way to think about the business and economic news at the end of what feels like a very long week. It literally took something that has never happened before. Hello, North Korea. To knock the economy off the front pages, so to speak. But we are going to put it right back on because, first of all, 313,000 new jobs were added to this economy in February, and B, tariffs. Here with the what happened and why of the past 5 days are Lee Gallagher. She is at Fortune Magazine. David Gura is a host, anchor, I guess they call it in TV, right, Gura, at MSNBC, right? Isn't that what they call it in television?
You got it.
All right, good. Hey, so Lee, let me get to you first. 313,000 new jobs, the unemployment rate of 4.1%. Is there anything not to like about this?
This was really hard not to like. I mean, you know, the key thing here was that wages were up, but they weren't up too much, which was the one thing that freaked everybody out last month because everyone's just on pins and needles waiting for a sign of inflation, and they thought that was it. And so now that's calmed everyone, and that number is huge. So, you know, I can't find anything.
Speechless is what she is. All right. So listen. So David, let me pick up on what she said, which is everybody was worried about inflation. I'm going to use a different word and say overheating. Can we roll with that for a little while?
Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem like the economy is overheating from what we saw today. What Lee was saying is exactly right. Wages didn't go up hugely. You've got this really low unemployment rate, and I think a lot of policymakers are wondering, how long can it stay that low? Is it going to go lower? Is still a lot of people, I think, still wondering about this concept of full employment. So the Fed's wrestling with that, but the Fed has forecasted out, I think, 3 rate increases this year. It seems like they're going to stay on target in light of what we saw today. Obviously, the big concern is if you saw that kind of inflation, if you saw the economy overheating, as you say, the Fed might act quickly. And when the Fed acts quickly, that could have an adverse effect on the economy.
Well, so Lee, let me just really briefly touch on something that goes along with what David was saying, which is we are now injecting huge amounts of fiscal stimulus, tax cuts, and more deficit spending into this economy that is almost at full employment, which is going fine. And there is some little downstream risk here. Yeah.
There is, absolutely. And, you know, another point is, I mean, we're going to be paying for that for generations. I mean, that has so many implications that are not really being discussed enough right now. But another thing, just getting back to the overheating point, is that there is going to be another downturn. Mm-hmm. And the key thing is the Fed needs ammo to be able to deal with it. And so that, you know, as much as, you know, the interest rates are important when they come. I mean, we need them.
Interestingly enough, this is not actually a question, David, but a comment. Bill Gates said this week, oh, look, we're going to have another financial crisis. And we're like, oh, okay, great. Thanks, Bill. all right, let me turn to trade, since that was the big story of this week, David. And it goes like this. The president has said he is acting to protect American jobs, which he and the White House staff clearly believe. Peter Navarro, his chief trade guy, clearly believe that. What they're protecting, though, are steel producing jobs, not the downstream jobs.
Absolutely. And just you look at the numbers. There are like 140,000 jobs in the steel industry right now. You compare that to the size of the industry that uses steel for manufacturing. That is a much larger number. I mean, I was mystified until I wasn't by how this happened. I mean, it happened quickly and impulsively. And we all read about how that came about this week. And I think what we've seen in the days since is really, this White House just trying to figure out what it's going to do. We saw these exemptions for Canada and for Mexico. Obviously, Europe made some threats of its own that it's going to levy taxes or tariffs on bourbon and jeans and quintessential American products as it sort of waits to see if it's going to be exempt as well. So it seems like, you know, we've had the opening salvos of a trade war here. We're going to see what's going to happen. But my sense is the White House, like the rest of us, is trying to figure all this out.
We have 14 days, Lee, by statute, until these things go into effect. Do we think the Europeans are going to hold their fire, or are they just going to go at the president and say, you know what, you're either with us or you're against us?
I think they're gonna get together and try to negotiate something. I think they're not going to just accept these But, you know, these have a lot of unintended consequences, including, I mean, you know, President Trump thinks he's doing this for the steel workers, but we export a lot of coal, yeah. and it's going to hurt the coal workers. It's going to hurt. A lot of our imports are not for our consumer goods. They are for U.S. producers who make things. And so it goes into everything. And so it's really complicated.
David, I want to touch briefly on Peter Navarro, who I just mentioned, who is the president's chief trade advisor. Gary Cohn, who used to be, or still is, I suppose, but has announced his plans to resign. Used to be the head of the National Economic Council. There is a tide turning, it seems, in economic policy at the White House.
Yeah, Peter Navarro, this professor of economics based out in California, found his way into the White House. He had his influence kind of diminished. Now it's back again. You know, we can play the parlor game of who's in power when it comes to this small economic team within the White House. I think you're right. I think the tide has turned, and we'll see how long that lasts. But I think it's you can't overstate sort of the importance of Gary Cohn leaving, what that means to investors. He's somebody that they, if they didn't know him, they felt like they knew him. And I think when that's gone, that's going to be a big difference.
Right. David Gura, he is an anchor at MSNBC. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, two things about that. Number one, it's worth a mention that the Dow hit its financial crisis low 9 years ago today. 6,547 was the bottom on the Dow, although to be fair, we didn't know it was the bottom at the time, which kind of gets me to item number two. Next week is the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Bear Stearns, the moment a whole lot of people started paying a whole lot more attention to the financial crisis and how much trouble we were in. To that end, I'm going to sit down on Tuesday with the three people who were right at the center of that crisis, former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve, and Tim Geithner, then of the New York Fed, later Hank Paulson's successor at Treasury. It'll be their first conversation as a group about what happened a decade ago, and we've put together a little teaser video to remind you what was going on. Check it out on our Facebook page. We are Marketplace APM. And while you're there, leave us a comment, suggest a question for me to ask them, if you like. About actual Wall Street today? Nothing but up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is kind of a meta question to be asked about this morning's jobs report. Remember, it's 313,000 new jobs in the economy last month. The unemployment rate was steady at 4.1%. And the question goes like this. With the economy doing as well as it is and the labor market already pretty much firing on all cylinders, where are all the workers we are going to need to keep up that momentum going to come from? We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out this morning to figure it out.
If you were the all-powerful Oz of the labor market, with job openings going unfilled and employers screaming they can't hire enough skilled workers, you'd want to find some people like these two women.
My name is Michelle Kennedy, and I live in Sioux City, Iowa. I work for the city in the parking garages.
Amber Pryor, Richmond, Virginia, SPCA admissions counselor.
Kennedy and Pryor both work part-time, 20 to 25 hours a week. If they went full-time or added a second job, they would be ideal workers in a tight labor market. But when I asked if they want to do that, Pryor said,
"Not at the moment. The kids are still young, so want to be around for them. I also write my free time, so that might also take off."
Kennedy said her husband earns a good salary, and right now, going full-time isn't worth it.
"My boss is retiring within the next couple of years, and I would like to have her job."
Economist Kathy Barrera at job site ZipRecruiter says any potential workers still on the sidelines at this point in the recovery might have other priorities.
Caring for family, including children or elderly relatives, whether they want to go back to school.
Meanwhile, employers now have to do more to get the workers they need, says Michael Gritton. He heads up workforce development in Louisville, Kentucky, where the local unemployment rate is 3.2%.
Employers are willing to work with folks with criminal records more than they were when the unemployment rate was 7 or 8%. They clearly are trying to keep people in the workforce or attract people back who are 55 plus.
Gritton says companies are also trying to recruit more young people by supporting work readiness programs in local high schools. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
After a little bit of backing and forthing by the White House today, it looks like the meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is, in fact, on for sometime later this spring. Surprising is one good word for how the whole thing went down last night. Why now is another. The Trump administration and a lot of the commentary on this story today have said, in basically these words, hey, look, sanctions work. We asked Marketplace's Aaron Schrank to check that out.
The United Nations has been sanctioning North Korea since the regime's first nuclear test in 2006. Those measures have focused mostly on its weapons programs. Abe Denmark runs the Asia program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He says the sanctions approach started to change at the end of Barack Obama's presidency.
In 2016, the Obama administration got a resolution through the UN Security Council focusing on reducing North Korea's ability to interact with the global economy.
President Trump built on that, putting sanctions on companies and people who do business in North Korea, especially in China. Denmark says the recent focus is on cutting off North Korea's access to international capital and resources.
So that means clamping down on the banking sector, but most significantly, it meant reducing trade in coal and targeting oil trade and North Korean labor exports.
Evan Medeiros at the Eurasia Group says there's no question that all those North Korean exports have declined.
The problem is that there's very little hard quantifiable evidence that denying them exports of these commodities and these raw materials has had a significant effect on the finances of the government because the North Koreans are master smugglers.
The question is it these new economic sanctions that have forced North Korea to set up direct talks with the West? That's hard to say, says Jim Walsh at MIT's Security Studies program.
And everyone's saying that. I am really skeptical about that. First of all, what's the evidence for that? We have sanctions, they changed their policy, therefore the sanctions caused the change of policy. Really, that's what you're going to say?
President Trump says the North Korean sanctions will remain in place until North Korea agrees to denuclearize, but it's still unclear what that means. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Black Panther phenomenon continues. The Marvel, really, I should say, the Disney blockbuster opened in China today, bringing its estimated worldwide box office to $920 million. It's the perfect time for retailers to cash in on the movie's success with a slew of Panther-themed merchandise, toys, T-shirts, backpacks, and whatnot. Turns out, though, the merch is in short supply. Marketplace's Renata Sago went in search of why.
Make way for a new kind of warrior. Or vibranium-powered action on the prowl.
In this commercial from toymaker Hasbro, kids leap from their backyards into the fictional African nation of Wakanda in their Black Panther vibranium hero gear. Julie Lynette with a market research group NPD says the plastic mask and retractable claw are part of about 11 items officially branded by Marvel that stores are carrying.
Which is pretty low compared to some of the other action movies that came out last year.
She says in the first full week after Black Panther's release, it ranked third in terms of toy sales, behind Star Wars and Cars the movie, and that shows clear demand for product. But the slim options have to do with retailers and toy makers' cautious approach, according to Richard Gottlieb, who heads the research group Global Toy Experts.
The more that's unknown, the greater the uncertainty, and there is no precedent for a black superhero in a leading role.
He adds, movies overall are a big risk for toy makers. For David Schick, managing partner at the retail analysis firm Consumer Edge Research, the success of Black Panther is an eye-opener for the industry to develop more options.
They'll get some in over time. You can be sure that they know there's margin there.
He expects the demand will last through the end of the year. Retailers' biggest season for gains. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The more gender balanced an environment is, the more physically safe women are.
Makes total sense. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 440 points, 1.7% today. I personally, were it my choice, would have gone with the really happy music. 25,335. The NASDAQ up 132, 1.7% there as well. 75 and 60. S&P 500 up 47 points. Wait for it. 1.7%. 5.7%, 2786. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 3.2%, NASDAQ up 4.1%, S&P 500 gained 3.5%. Toymakers tumbled after reports that the troubled chain Toys R Us is about to close all of its U.S. stores. Mattel dropped 7.1% today. Hasbro down 2%. Bank stocks advanced in line with higher bond yields, which means banks can charge higher interest rates on loans. JPMorgan Chase up 2.8%. Capital One Financial gained 2.6% today. Bond prices fell, which means, as I said, the yield went up. 10-year Treasury notes at 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last August, we took a trip to South Carolina for a couple of stories about globalization and how that state is a place where globalization is working. 26 years ago, BMW, the German carmaker, decided to build what would become its biggest manufacturing plant on the planet in Spartanburg, upstate South Carolina, bringing with it thousands of jobs and billions of dollars of both direct and indirect investment for a plant that sends 70% of the cars it builds out into the global economy.
They go to Germany, they go to Europe, China, Asia. So they go everywhere.
I talked to a guy by the name of David Britt while we were in town. He's on the Spartanburg County Council, and after the tariff news this week, we figured it would be a good idea to get him back on the phone. Mr. Britt, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you again, too, Kai.
So what's going through your mind right now, sir, as these tariffs now are a thing?
Well, I was hoping and praying that this was not going to come to pass. Very concerned. My stomach is churning, and my mind is swirling.
When we were down there last year in Spartanburg, going out to the BMW plant and all of that, you and I sat down. We had a long chat about how it came to pass and how it took years for you to get that BMW plant. How worried are you now with these tariffs and the threat of retaliation from the European Union and Germany? How worried are you that things might go south a little bit?
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, not only for the best manufacturing company I've ever worked with, BMW. Not only concerned for them, and we've got over 40 suppliers to them in Spartanburg and the neighboring counties with probably 34,000 people employed just supporting BMW. But we have 125 international companies here in Spartanburg. I'm concerned for them, mainly their employees and their customers that they provide product to. I mean, this could have a devastating effect across the board, because it is going to have a major effect here in Spartanburg County and in South Carolina.
When I was down there a number of months ago, you said to me, when I asked you about the president and his trade policies, because there was, we all kind of knew that this was coming based on his statements during the campaign. You said you think the president lacks understanding, and you were hoping that he would come down to South Carolina and talk to y'all and the folks who work at BMW and some of those industries. Do you think you can still help the president understand globalization, or has that ship sailed?
No. I mean, again, my invitation is wide open to the president. I would love for both the president and his team to come down here and let us show him. We have companies, like I say, from the Pacific Rim to Canada, Mexico, and all points in between that have come here to manufacture and build their businesses. And this is one of the things that concerns me greatly. With the president's actions in the last year, we have seen an explosion of international companies wanting to come here. I mean, it's been unbelievable. They can't get their businesses built quick enough.
And you're saying, just to be clear, sir, you're saying that's because the president has done things like changing regulations and the tax law and all that jazz, and it's made it more attractive now for companies come to your part of the country.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the proof's in the pudding.
Yep.
Those policies have worked, but now all of a sudden,
let me put it a little more plainly. Is he shooting himself in the foot here, do you think?
I don't think he's shooting himself. I think he's shooting the American taxpayer and citizen and employee in the foot. And that's the biggest concern. This action could have devastating effects across the board, and it could actually kill these great opportunities that we're having right now. And like I say, I have no problem with people who don't trade with us fairly. Deal with them. So I said it last year. Mr. President, you deal with the countries, let us deal with the companies.
Yeah.
And be careful how you deal with these companies, because you can put your foot on the throat of growth, and that's not good for anybody.
David Britt, he is on the Spartanburg County Council down in Spartanburg, South Carolina, runs economic development, actually, for the council. Mr. Britt, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Have a great day.
You can hear those stories we did from Spartanburg, by the way, and the whole globalization series they were a part of. We called it Trade-Offs at our website, marketplace.org. We've been rolling out the results of the sixth wave of our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll this week. Lots of good stuff in there about how our workforce is changing, what people are really worried about economically. And today, a subject we've included in that survey for the first time, sexual harassment in the workplace. More than 25% of the women we polled say they have experienced sexual harassment at work, and an even greater proportion told us they had left a job or switched careers entirely as a result of harassment. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports from WESA in Pittsburgh.
When Nilufer Merchant started her career in tech, it was the late 80s, and Silicon Valley was even more male-dominated than it is now. Merchant says sexual harassment was a constant at the high-profile companies where she worked, so she changed jobs a lot.
And so it meant I didn't get to build up the momentum that essentially a guy would be able to build up because they weren't facing the same obstacles.
Merchant went on to become a successful consultant, author, and speaker on workplace culture. Still, she wonders how things might have been different had she not felt the need to move around so much.
My career has been shaped by most, more than any other factor, is the level of sexual harassment I faced.
Nearly half the women we polled said, like Merchant, they had changed jobs as a result of harassment. Heather McLaughlin is a sociologist who studied the economic effects of sexual harassment on working women. She found that the majority who said they'd experienced it on the job left their companies within 2 years. That's higher than average.
Many also suffered career stagnation, so their earnings really plateaued when compared to women who continued on in those same career paths.
Even complaining can be costly. Women who do can end up without references and scrambling for income between jobs. And speaking up can be even harder for women who are paid less, says Maya Raghu with the National Women's Law Center.
Women are the majority of workers in low-wage jobs, and many of those women are also women of color or immigrant women.
Raghu is the center's director of workplace equity and also works with the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund.
And when you are in a low-wage job, it's much more difficult for you to take that risk to speak up and challenge sexual harassment.
Our poll found that roughly 30% of women felt that harassment was something they could report without fear, a figure that echoes findings by the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Leanne Meyer with Carnegie Mellon's Business School says women who switch jobs tend to move into industries where there are more women.
The more gender balanced an environment is, the more physically safe women are. So they're absolutely safer.
But safety is becoming a bigger concern for many companies. Elizabeth Bill is a lawyer with the Society for Human Resource Management. She says as a result of all the recent attention paid to sexual harassment.
So organizations are very interested in not only addressing legal sexual harassment or sexual harassment that violates the law, but also those precursor behaviors or those behaviors that cause discomfort or concerns in the workplace.
Bill's organization represents nearly 300,000 HR professionals at thousands of companies. Bill says a third of those companies have increased sexual harassment training and awareness, and another big chunk plans to do so. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We've put the data, should you be curious, from our Marketplace Edison Research poll online. It lives at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which is not, repeat, not an endorsement. I saw this in the British paper The Telegraph. A study out of Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada showing And let me say again here, this is not an endorsement, especially if my bosses are listening. Anyway, actual academic research showing that taking out one's workplace frustrations on a voodoo doll of one's boss can help lower workplace stress. Here is the actual quote from the researcher. As weird as it sounds, she said, a simple and harmless symbolic act of retaliation can make people feel like they are getting even and restoring their sense of fairness, end quote. Again, not an endorsement. Okay, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 440 points today, 1.7%. NASDAQ up 132. That is 1.7%. S&P 500 up 1.7%. That works out to 47 points on that particular index. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.